Donkey Kong isn't important enough to hate. Donkey Kong Jr., on the other hand, is a fucking monster. Donkey Kong Jr. is the one you are familiar with because he's Donkey Kong's son, if I have my lore correct. It's been a while. There's also the rest of the family, and with the exception of...
What did Donkey Kong Jr. do?
Okay, so wait. Back up. So to clarify this, I believe what Ed is referring to with Donkey Kong Jr. here is that the actual character people are playing in Donkey Kong Bonanza is Donkey Kong Jr.
Correct.
Even though they only call him Donkey Kong. He is the son of the Donkey Kong from the 80s video game with Mario.
That's true.
Okay.
Because Donkey Kong Jr. was the second game where Mario was the villain. He had the original Donkey Kong in a cage. And Donkey Kong Jr. was trying to rescue him. And that's a noble pursuit. But then he went corporate. You've got him running around like he has just a collar and a tie. What is with this? This isn't good. This is, we should not be teaching gorillas to do meetings. I don't feel okay with this. I feel like there's a...
That'll work. Yeah, that was fucking insane, but it'll work. Dear God. Okay.
Cranky Kong. That's it.
Cranky Kong. Nicely done. Yeah.
Yeah. I kept wanting to say Grumpy Kong, but yeah, it's Cranky Kong.
No, the grumpy one is Ed.
Yeah.
Look, I have standards about my gorillas.
This is Normal Men, a podcast from four men who are clinging desperately to normalcy in an era when that's asking a bit too much. I'm George in Charlotte.
This is Proctor Malone in Washington, D.C.
I'm low-tech speedrun enjoyer in outer Florida.
I'm Ed from Boston.
Hey folks, I'm Ed in Boston, and welcome to this week's episode of Normal Men. Let's talk for a sec, or an hour, whatever. We try to stick to topics that are timely, or at least infesting our blue sky timelines, and I think we've got one this week that I dare say we can speak authoritatively about. Fair warning, I think it's going to start in a bit of a rough place, but I think we've got something worth saying on the whole deal. George, lay it on us.
Fast food delivery. Fast food delivery, folks. The normal men are committed men in their 30s and 40s who do occasionally use DoorDash. And look, we're never going to give you a hard time for ordering the occasional hamburger. That is not what we're about here. And in fact, I think ordering the occasional hamburger and having it delivered to you by someone is honestly a pretty normal thing to do in today's America. And
we are the richest empire in the history of the earth.
I would like to say that I did have McDonald's for dinner because I woke up late and had no other alternatives, but I drove and got it myself.
And look, that is normal. There's nothing you can tell me to say nobody should ever be getting delivery food. No one should ever get delivery fast food. No one should ever, I don't know, whatever. But folks, we have a gentleman who I think is a very useful insight into the opposite extreme. Really, the sort of extreme that I think we need a little less of in this country these days. And in fact, in his case, given that he is now departed, which we'll get to, we have a little less of in this country. So this week, if you spend any time on Blue Sky, you probably saw a screenshot of a Twitter post from a gentleman named Jason Steen, who was the former editor of a local news outlet, think TMZ with more mugshots of DUIs for Nashville. Scoop Nashville, it was called. Jason had heart failure in 2017, very serious, and then a heart transplant. So this is an organ transplant survivor, which kudos to anyone that can survive that. That is an incredibly grueling thing to put your body through, and it's an extreme thing. And he eventually died of heart failure in 2024. He was also known for posting to social media, specifically Twitter, lists of how his spending on DoorDash broke down. If you haven't seen one of these things, it's really...
It's a lot.
His original post on this was an observation that he spent something like $40,000 on DoorDash in 2022. He posted this at the beginning.
$25,000 in 2022, and then $40,000 in 2023.
Yes. So let's do a rundown of 2023, because this is the last data we got on this before Jason's heart literally gave out.
I like that you're, this is the last data we got on this. Like it's like it's a fucking St. Louis Fed report or something.
Look, my man, I have a brand and it is data first, and that's how it's always going to be.
Did you bring a pivot table to share with the class?
No, because Jason already made it for me. Right? I feel like posted it to Twitter.
I feel like there should be an all caps Bloomberg headline after you say that or something. Like
$5,642 of Chick-fil-A.
Yes. Chili's, $3,835.52. McDonald's. Keep in mind, this isn't spending at these restaurants. This is delivery on DoorDash from these restaurants. McDonald's, $2,079.38. Applebee's, $1,920.45. Freddy's Frozen Custard and Steak Burgers, which I actually live walking distance from one of their outlets, and we do occasionally get custard there. And their burgers are fun because they're the classic mustard, pickle, onion. They're not messing around with what they call California style with the tomatoes and lettuce unless you ask for it. This man got $1,787.08 worth of delivery from Freddy's Frozen Custard and Steak Burgers.
If we could circle back to Applebee's real quick.
Yeah, let's do that.
I believe there were two lines for Applebee's, right? Because one was Applebee's grill ampersand bar, and the other one was Applebee's grill plus sign bar. So you have to sum those up if we're going to do this right.
I'd really rather not. I'd have to think about it.
I think that might have been the 2022 version. The 2023 version, I think, only has the ampersand. I'm looking.
I think you are correct.
DoorDash finally settled on the one true Applebee's descriptor.
Yeah. I mean, this is a guy who has already gotten a heart transplant, and he is spending $1,024.42 on delivery donuts from Shipley Donuts, on top of $449.91 of delivery donuts from Krispy Kreme.
I don't know if he ever actually confirmed this, but one definitely got the sense, flipping through his Twitter feed, that he was eating these meals exclusively alone.
Okay, what's the Taco Bell number?
$948.71. He was downright moderate with Taco Bell.
It's really hard to spend a lot of money at Taco Bell.
Yeah, I was going to say, couldn't you just buy Taco Bell for $900?
Also have a Taco Bell in walking distance, and you can get over $15 a lot faster than you'd think these days, but not, I mean, delivery Taco Bell, $900.
Like, the thing that gets me is not this. I mean, this is more sad than anything, I think. But, like, as is Blue Sky's habit, we got discourse out of it. The discourse machine began immediately as soon as this hit. And we got some of the most, can you poach an egg and get it delivered by DoorDash? I don't know, but some of these people, brains might never recover.
And we got it in both directions too, which is fun, right? Like the delivery food. Okay. Look, we're being critical of this guy's eating habits. Let me make one thing clear. Food is always political. Food is political because life is political. Food is it's very low on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? It's like food and clean water are about as basic as you can get. And human beings use food to flex on each other all day long, every day. It is inherent in human nature. Everything you hear about food has embedded value judgments, embedded cultural judgments, embedded inequality, embedded economic organization. It is highly, highly political, and it reflects the society that is in question. And in our society, conversations about food and how it gets to your door, or really to your mouth, are expressions of a society that is highly consumerist, highly unequal. There is so much to unpack here, and it's important to just say that so that it's understood that we are talking about stuff beyond this is different from how I do it, and therefore it's crazy. There is so much going on here, and it's not just Jason Steen making decisions. There is way more to it than just that.
Tony Bourdain over here.
There's one thing we should really also make clear, because I think we kind of skipped over it. Like, it's sad when anyone goes out before their time, but also this guy's a real piece of shit. And I feel like we should probably make that clear. Like, his TMZ style rag, like, would post people's mugshots and then blackmail them to take them down.
Yep.
Like, there's a certain amount of venom that I think you can treat some cases with that you can't others. But like, I don't want folks to think that this is just some punching down shit. This guy.
So with that said, the expression of food for this guy is, I think, incredibly revealing, right? He is transacting at places that are the most mass marketed you could possibly imagine. And I don't say that to say that mass marketed food is necessarily bad. It isn't necessarily bad. I eat at McDonald's. I eat at Taco Bell. I mentioned eating at Freddy's. I will occasionally have Chick-fil-A. I am not above people eating fast food and, you know, quite the opposite. And I'm also not above people ordering food. But the sheer volume this guy was engaging in, it just makes it such a compelling synthesis of someone who is being handed by an algorithm-driven, an app-driven access to cheap calories that his brain just couldn't handle. Yep. Right? Like, this is a heart transplant guy stuffing thousands of dollars of donuts and hamburgers and fried chicken down his mouth via delivery, which sounds like really harsh to say. And I'm sure there was stuff in Jason Steen's life that meant those decisions weren't entirely his own. We cannot unpack this man from the system he exists in. And the algorithms of DoorDash and the cheap access to high calorie food that both that platform and all of the different restaurants that were on it created for this guy are not his choices alone. I don't think we should necessarily think of this as one guy getting wild with it to the point that he ate himself to death. And that's the whole story. I think there's so much else going on. But I also think that this is an extreme example of someone who took this to just a crazy level, both in terms of the amount of money he was spending, the amount of calories he was consuming, the kind of calories he was consuming, the kind of food he was consuming. And it makes it so compelling to talk about for that reason. Not to say that anybody who's engaging in any of these things independently is somehow not worthy. Very much the opposite.
Yeah, like these things are normal, but, you know, moderation's a thing.
Yeah, I mean, this was somebody who had settled on a normal meal being $15 to $20 at a restaurant where $15 to $20 gets you a day and a half's worth of calories. You know, he was consistent in that. And he was consistent in that in part because the realities and logistics of how the food was being delivered to him, I think that's important, meant that this was the path of least resistance, that it was easy for him to go and get his daily sustenance through DoorDash. And so that's what he did.
And I mean, they also are very complicit in some of the stuff. And you know that because they're a company that has an app. But like, they send you push notifications, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the best things I have ever done for my life is turn off every push notification that is not a text from my wife or this group chat. So, you know, congratulations, guys. But like... At the same time, like I'm legit serious about that. I don't have the attention span. I will just go be distracted forever, and that's on things that are way less self-destructive than, you know, powering down $40 of food, right? And like it's scary the amount by which pretty much any application can get into your head.
Yeah.
I used to be peripherally involved in games. I never worked for a game developer, but I knew a lot of people who did. I participated in the local scene. And one of the things that actually made me sort of move away from making video games is it became very obvious that there were really, really good levers you could use to mess with people's brains. And that a lot of things at the time, we were talking about MMOs and stuff like that, but then gacha games and stuff like similar came into play. And this is just that, but with a doggy bag on the other side.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that most people can do to stop that except for just shutting it off. And most people aren't willing to do that because it's normalized into their everyday life, right? You do see the exact same thing in like people who spend a ton of money on pulls for a gacha game, right? They're like, well, it's Monday, I got paid, I'm going to go spend $20 on this. And it's not really any different. It's just the numbers and what is causing the endorphins changes.
Yeah.
And when we end up back in a position of power, I think this maps very closely to things like gambling, because it's really the same grift. And I really hope we spend a lot more attention on this stuff. I'm not saying that DoorDash radicalizes people, but I'm definitely at least somewhat sympathetic to the idea that having all of these attention competition devices stuffed into your life all the time probably makes you a little crazy.
Well, it changes your relationship to food, right? You're mediating it through your phone, through an info system rather than through your body's feedback systems, or rather than through any other source of habit that might, you know, you get up in the morning, you make breakfast, you eat breakfast, you eat lunch at a certain time, you come home, you eat dinner. Maybe that's how many people operate.
I agree with Ed. I believe that when we return to power in 2029, inshallah, we're going to need to throw all of the DoorDash people and all of the gamers into re-education camps in order to fix our society.
Normal Man, not an LLC, does not endorse that statement.
I'm like halfway there.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll talk.
What drives me up the wall with this whole DoorDash discourse, as we refer to it on Blue Sky, is that people treat it as like it's the civil rights movement or something. Like that it's dug so far, to y'all's points about the apps digging into our brains, it's dug so far into people's brains. And I do think it has radicalized some people. And I think that problem is likely to get worse given our media environment. But I don't really care how people spend their money. Spend your money however the hell you want to. If you want to get a bunch of food delivered, that's great. If you want to play those terrible little games that they advertise on Instagram every third post or so, then go nuts. But it's not some great moral cause to attach yourself to.
It's kind of interesting the way that the battle lines on this break down differently in different places. On Blue Sky, the DoorDash defenders are heavily associated with disability advocacy, that this is something where this is an accessibility thing for some people. And I totally hear that this is food delivery can be a lifeline for people who, for whatever reason, have a hard time preparing food for themselves or going to go get it for themselves, where that is a higher marginal barrier to the activity,
right,
yeah, than it would be for somebody else. I think that, you know, there's a reductio ad absurdum of this where, you know, where you have to make up a guy who is literally incapable of obtaining sustenance in any other way than...
And in minimal fairness, like, I live in an area where there are delivery apps directly for grocery stores, not just DoorDash. DoorDash does... And the other ones, too. We keep using DoorDash, but, I mean, you can take all of them. I used to know some pretty high-up people in Grubhub. It's not any different. But, like, they do have actual supermarkets on there sometimes, for sure. That's absolutely a thing. But at the same time, right, like, some areas have more dedicated stuff, right? And the delivery fees are way lower. But yeah, like, it does feel like there's a certain amount of making up a guy to get mad for some of this, where you just beggar belief that somebody should be ordering out 5 days a week.
Yeah. Well, and some of this harkens back to pandemic economics and pandemic customs, that, you know, everybody was isolated and delivery food was seen, rightly or wrongly, as a way to, you know, have your standard of living persist in some way, despite the fact that you couldn't leave your house. And also the labor markets were very weird for a time in there, because we had lots of money flowing into the economy and also lots of idle workers, many of whom were looking to freelance, and make some extra money through something like gig economy, because we had lots of furloughs, lots of layoffs, during the most acute period of the pandemic. You know, shortly after that, labor costs went crazy, and that was a double whammy for the DoorDash types, and that happened coincident with the Federal Reserve taking the punch bowl away. Many of the long-term subsidy plays into some of these ventures, where services that had previously been money losing for the vendors had their costs go way up.
Some numbers here are really helpful, and I'm just going to use DoorDash because it's convenient to just focus on one company. They're representative of the industry as a whole. prior to the third quarter of 2024, so this would be the period ending September 30th of last year, the company had broken even, as in made any money at all after all costs, one quarter in its history. That was at the height of the pandemic, right? When delivery demand went absolutely nuts. Up until literally 9 months ago, this company never made money, essentially.
So you're telling me they are a modal startup?
Right. They are still growing very rapidly throughout this, and they're not losing enormous amounts of money. It's not like they're losing hundreds of billions of dollars, but they are losing substantial amounts of money. At the same time, the take rate, which basically refers to the amount, the percentage that the company holds onto relative to what the consumer pays. So if you pay $50 and the take rate is 10%, that means $45 is going to the merchant and $5 is going to DoorDash, roughly is how to think about this. Their take rate has never been higher than roughly 13.5%. And that hasn't moved much over the years. So in 2019, it was 11.5% and it's now 13.5%. It hasn't moved a ton. These companies are not making huge changes in terms of how much they're holding on to.
No, it's just an availability thing.
Right. They are not making huge amounts of money. The change in cost, all of the complaints about the change in cost are about the increasing price of food, the increasing price of labor, and that's basically it. Just a benchmark, like how the accounting works for these guys. They have their gross market value, and then you get a take rate, and that's your revenue number, and then you have costs. All your costs then come out of that. So their gross margin is about 50%, which is high for a tech company, or sorry, low for a tech company. But from an accounting perspective, the money you send to the app in your transaction when you order on DoorDash, upwards of 80% of that, 87% of that, isn't their revenue. They're not claiming that as revenue. They're just in one hand, out the other to the merchant.
And the driver.
Whether that merchant is McDonald's, the local pizza place, whoever. Everything else is what is then their revenue. That's the take rate, that percentage. And then their revenue has to cover the costs of operating the app, marketing to businesses, stimulating demand by offering people coupons and rebates and whatever. Obviously, returns to shareholders if you even get to that point, which, again, until very recently, they haven't gotten to. These companies are... Over the entire existence of the platform economy, whether it's DoorDash, Uber Eats, I mean, even Uber and Lyft, really, I mean, they're a little further along, but not dramatically further. These companies were selling dollars for pennies, and they did a truly exceptional job of getting every one of their customers to think that that cost structure was there forever in a way that it was not ever going to be that way.
Well, Uber sure did. Have you looked at Lyft stock lately? I just pulled it up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean...
$14.
I just want to circle back that Propter mentioned back when the pandemic was going. And George or Ed, I want one of y'all to clip that sentence from Propter so that I can send it to Taylor Lorenz.
I already have her calling online.
Is the heat from her apartment radiating through your phone?
That would explain why my office is slightly warmer than hell right now.
Yes, we should acknowledge that all past pandemics, at least all past viral pandemics, are still going. We are still experiencing the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918. We actually are. That's still a thing.
The term endemic doesn't exist. Yes, it deleted. It never happened. Unlike the pandemic, which is still happening. I think the other thing, just to be really normal about this, fellas, ladies, everybody, please get a physical. Just go to your doctor once a year. They'll grab a couple vials of blood, take your blood pressure, weigh you, ask you some questions. You're out of there in half an hour. Just get a physical. Please get a physical. If you want to then make an informed decision about how much fried chicken you're eating, whether you're exercising or not, whether you should be on medication of one kind or another, anything like that, then that's on you. That's your choice to make. We're not going to tell you what choices you should be making about your health. But you need, as the data guy, you need the information. Get a physical as a favor to us. We'd sure appreciate it.
Also, stop delivering Taco Bell. The old El Paso kits at the grocery store are much better than Taco Bell.
You can buy the sauce at the grocery store now.
You can buy Baja Blast. There's no reason to go there.
The Old El Paso ones are better than the Taco Bell kits. Get yourself an Old El Paso taco kit, a soft taco dinner kit. Get you a pound of ground beef. Get you a tomato.
Just one. Don't be fancy.
Yeah, don't be fancy. Get a tomato, some shredded lettuce, some Mexican cheese blend. You're good to go. It'll take you 10 minutes.
No onion?
No.
That's kind of overachieving.
We got to make baby steps with folks here, Ed.
That's true. And I have not lived in the backcountry for a while. I defer to your expertise.
Yes, yes. And folks, it's perfectly fine to buy the jar of Rouse sauce. You're like, Nona is not going to pound down your door and start yelling at you with her fingers stuck together.
But cooking is so fun, though. And I won't buy the Rouse sauce because I love my tomato sauce recipe. And that's I love making it. And it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, I have two modes. We have a standing freezer here, and it's full of tomato sauce. But sometimes I don't plan to. I know you're all shocked. And so I get a can, and then I throw some vegetables in it. And my lovely wife cannot help it. Which honestly is saying something about my pasta sauce that I shouldn't really introspect on too much, but you know, you can get by.
You can get by, and there's nothing wrong with using Rouse. There's nothing wrong with spending 18 hours making your own pasta sauce, which I have done this before. It was great, but like I don't have 18 hours most of the time, and I have a kid now.
It wasn't 18 hours great. I've been there.
Yeah, well, you know, it was part of a timpano. It's a whole thing. Anyhow.
I'm not spending 18 hours making sauce. No, forget about that.
I did that once for demi-glace, and nope, I'm good.
None of us are Italian. We should not be spending that long making sauce.
The thing about cooking, though, and about it being a skill that I think everyone should have a little bit of, you know, again, I'm going to reference back to the conversation we had about accessibility. There are folks that physically cooking is just never going to be something they are capable of doing regularly or for large numbers of people or whatever. And look, 100%, I'm not talking to y'all. I'm talking to everybody else. And I will say to everybody else, you should be able to cook. You should be able to cook 2-3 meals minimum that you can feed yourself with, because when you do that, it changes how you engage with food. It changes how you taste food. It changes how you order food. It changes how you appreciate the people that clean up for you when you eat at a restaurant, or makes you appreciate being able to just toss away the takeout containers when you don't have to do the dishes that night.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you think more about what you're eating, because you're thinking about, how would I cook this? If I wanted to try and cook this, what steps would I take? Do I have just no idea? Maybe I should just go look it up. It will spark intellectual curiosity in you. When someone eats food that you have made for them, that is a fundamentally different experience from buying them a meal. It is not the same thing. It will make your heart sing in a way that buying a meal for somebody, which is a great thing to do, and folks should do more of that too, but it won't make your heart sing in the same way. And if you ever have kids of your own one day, being able to cook with them, I mean, my daughter's 2, 2.5, and being able to crack eggs into a bowl is like a huge deal for this little lady. And she is so proud of herself when she gets the chance to do it. And she loves watching me stir a pot, and she loves eating the stuff I make. And if you're not at least a little bit down the road to all of that, you're missing out on some. It's like not being able to read, or not being able to, I don't know, doodle, right? Like it's a human impulse that you really will appreciate. So I think that's probably a fair summation of our stance.
I think literacy is a good call there, because like, I do want to touch on one thing there. It's not just literacy about food, right? But it's, and like, I don't think I have get off my lawn on this one here, but like, go outside. Go to the restaurant if you're able to, because like one of the things George said is really true. And it's like, you do start to understand just how much work this is, right? And it is not, parts of it are not fun work, right? Dishwashing, not fun.
Not fun.
The invention of the dishwasher is one of the greatest things to ever happen to human civilization. But like, you see people doing this stuff in a way that makes you understand a little bit more about the world around you, as opposed to just like having it appear at your doorstep with zero contact delivery naturally. But like, you see this with everything. It's not just food. You go to Home Depot, there are people stocking shelves, right? Like
100%.
You have some actual understanding of like how the world around you works. Not everything. It's a keyhole view, of course, but like, I find myself very nervous about the way that it, sure, posting is projection, right? Like, people are putting out exactly the sort of person they want to be. But I don't know what to say about somebody who decides that what they want to be is a person who never leaves their house.
You know, they call it the hospitality business, and I think that's an important element of this, that speaks to the human connection that exists in the hospitality business, in places like bars and in restaurants, and a lot of that is the result of the people who work in bars and restaurants.
Yeah, that word goes way back, a lot further than the hospitality business, and like it does mean something to people.
There's a reason they call it hospitaliano.
None of us are Italian.
How dare you do pinky fingers on my podcast?
Apparently, no one goes to Olive Garden either.
I can't remember the last time I went to Olive Garden. It's probably been every bit of 10 or 15 years.
I was in northern Vermont, I believe, or New Hampshire. They're basically interchangeable, except that the guns are hidden in one state.
I went about 6 months ago with my daughter after one of her little soccer practices. And yes, my daughter does play soccer at 2 years old. That it's playing soccer. It's not actually...
It's chasing a ball.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And half the time, half the kids don't want to do even that. And that's totally fine. Anyhow, listen, so we go to Olive Garden, and I'm gonna do a real get off my lawn here.
I'm here for it.
They had tablets at every table.
Oh.
My daughter does not spend a lot of time with screens. So when she sees one, she's like, ba-bang. And let me tell you, you will not appreciate what screens do to the human brain until you're raising a toddler and see how they want to engage with screens. It takes every ounce of hard work you can imagine to not just say, okay, sit in front of the TV, take the iPad, whatever. And, you know, lots of parents do that. And look, no judgment. Everyone's raising their kids their own way. We have decided to go a different route with it, and she gets very little screen time. And it is really hard to do that. It is really, really, really hard to do that. And these goddamn Olive Garden tablets at every table are not helping. And the meltdown she had when I had to take this dang thing and put it at the next table because she was trying to mess with it the whole time. My lawn has a no iPad sign. Get off of it.
I'm glad I grew up with bad screens.
My thing is going to be the Applebee's thing. Again, we got to circle back to Applebee's here.
Are you still hung up on the plus sign?
No. I'm hung up on the fact that the guy was ordering Applebee's.
Look, I am not going to shame somebody from ordering Applebee's. I have been in a place in my life.
No, that is, of all the restaurant, like, I'm a big fan of big chain restaurant. I love Chili's. I haven't been to an Olive Garden in forever, but Olive Garden's fine. Carrabba's is good. Outback, great. All this stuff. Not Applebee's.
You're missing something important.
What's that?
At least here, they deliver past midnight.
What, Applebee's does?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Not a good time of my life, I'll just tell you.
Being awake past midnight is considered haram, so.
Yes. Yes. As Internet Hippo has told us numerous times, bedtime is 10 p.m.
I haven't been in bed by 10 p.m. since.
I think the other thing that we should talk about with this subject is, I alluded to earlier with the idea that the decisions made around food are not 100% personal. And right now we are living through a political moment where one side of the spectrum has decided that we're going to start saying anybody who drinks soda deserves every piece of diabetes they get, and this is no longer our problem. The Make America Healthy Again movement that's led by RFK Jr. is, I think you could take that lens and apply it to both Jason Steen and the broader discussion we're having here and say, well, he got exactly what he deserved. It was 100% on him. He made bad choices, yada, yada, yada. And I just want to emphasize, while Jason Steen made decisions in his life, he had agency. there were things beyond his control acting on him as well. Whether it was his biology, whether it was, as we talked about, the role that apps and gamification of something as simple as eating now play in our lives, whether it was the imperatives of capitalism and how much time he had available and the things that he had available to...
And, you know, his blackmail ring.
And his blackmail ring, yes. Probably pretty lucrative, my guess would be. We put a lot of chum in the water in this conversation related to personal decisions that this particular person made. But I want to emphasize that just because someone makes bad decisions doesn't mean they don't have a right to healthcare or the resources to make better decisions or whatever support that society can offer them to thrive as a human being.
Yeah, like it sucks that like the Maha people are really putting the boots to their own in a really disgusting way. But it's also important to note that they are, right? Like they are putting the boot to their people in a really disgusting way. And like everyone has stuff on this, right? Like, I don't know. I've been, you know, I'm 5'10". I've been about 210, 220 pounds my entire adult life. And I walk 8 miles a day because I have two dogs that will kill me if I don't. You do like the Apple Watch and it's like 900 move calories a day minimum. And like still 210 because I like food.
Preach, brother. Love me some food.
Yeah. I see how much you run. It makes me dizzy and I'm not even doing it. This stuff happens. It is a thing. It is not something that is entirely in people's control.
I don't know what you guys are so mad about RFK for. He's putting the real sugar back in your damn Coke so that you guys can have your freaking Glonzo thing with this Mexican Coke.
Mr. Speedrun Enjoyer, what Coke?
It's glassware, man. It's glassware.
I'm not falling for big glassware.
What Coke?
As we said, going to bed after midnight is haram, and drinking caffeinated soda at 8:55 p.m. on a weeknight, similarly haram. You should be ashamed of yourself. It's bad enough that it's Diet Pepsi. The fact that you're consuming that at this hour of the night, young man, unacceptable.
Aren't I older than you?
Yes. Yes, you are. You are older than me.
Hi, it's your friendly neighborhood editor here. I'd just like you all to know that it is 8:51 p.m. on the 29th of July, and I'm having another delicious Diet Pepsi. But more to the point, I also wanted to dip in and say, I know the audio on this one's a little bit rough. I've raided my gear closet and shipped out some stuff to the other guys for the future. Hope this one's fun nonetheless.
Oh, look at the color he's turned. He's like fuchsia.
It's so hot in here.
It was like that the shift that he just, oh my god.
All right, we've done a lot of talking about treats tonight. We have a treat for all of you. Josie Riesman has agreed to come on the show to talk about the life and legacy of Hulk Hogan. If you're on Blue Sky, Josie probably doesn't need a whole lot of introduction, but she is, among her other many talents, the author of Ringmaster, Vince McMahon and the Unmaking of America, which is for my money, the definitive look at professional wrestling and American politics.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I emailed my favorite writer about wrestling, this guy Richard Meltzer, not to be confused with Dave Meltzer. And I was like, I have to send my... Actually, before I even wrote the piece, I emailed Richard because I consider it an honor that he'll be a correspondent with me occasionally. And the subject line was just, "You outlived Hulk Hogan." That was it. Because he hated Hogan. He is an old school fan from like the 50s, going way back. So yeah. He really wrote the definitive essay in 1985 about why Hogan and Vince McMahon were ruining wrestling. And thus the downstream effect would be the ruination of America. And I read this 1985 essay and was like, Jesus H, who gave this person the lathe of heaven? that was how I framed it when I emailed him then, was like, you outlived Hulk Hogan. And God bless, he wrote back and he was like, I suppose I did. That's a nice thing. It's
like, okay. So he was on this before the first Hulk Hogan heel turns.
This was like 1985 when he wrote this incredible piece, which I will send to you. And if you want to include it in the show notes, go right ahead, called The Last Wrestling Piece. And it was indeed, I think, his last wrestling piece. He had written a lot about wrestling as a culture critic. And then in 1985, he sort of throws his hands up in the air and writes this. There's a version that was cut down and put in the San Diego Reader and Alt Weekly. But there's a full version that he included in this compilation of his works. And I'm proud to say I am the exclusive digital host of the full-length version on the Ringmaster site. So you can check it out there, even if these jabronis don't put it on the show notes. But the last wrestling piece really blew my mind. Like, he just predicted everything that was going to happen, not just in wrestling, but the fact that wrestling would have downstream effects on culture and politics. He predicted all of that 40 years early, maybe 30 years early. But it was really remarkable. So anyway, we all outlived Hulk Hogan, I suppose, is the point.
And God bless us all for it.
So Josie's here to talk about Hulk Hogan specifically, but I think it would be helpful to put Hulk Hogan in the broader context.
Sure.
Before we get into his specific
issues? Contributions.
Contributions, yes, as a human being and to wrestling in general. So Josie, why don't you sort of give us the 5-minute history for people that don't watch
wrestling. For people who have, never heard of Hulk Hogan?
And not just him, but sort of where wrestling came from and how it sort of went on the arc it has.
Absolutely. Professional wrestling as we know it emerged from circus sideshows. Wrestling, like collegiate-type Olympic wrestling, had gotten popular during the Civil War because there were a lot of recent Irish immigrants who brought wrestling over from Ireland, and it caught on with soldiers. There would be soldiers in the Union Army who would be like, oh, what's this cool wrestling thing? So competitive wrestling started to get big in mid-century, 19th century. And then by the end of the century, like many sports, there were traveling carnivals that would be like, hey, you want to see a sport? Here's a sport. And it was always fixed. Like it was called hippodroming. It was such a novelty to see organized kinds of sports that people didn't really care if it was fake. So like they do that with anything. It's just that wrestling was the sole athletic event, with the exception, I guess, of the Harlem Globetrotters, who don't totally count. Wrestling was the sole athletic event that retained a completely fake version of itself. And those two things split off. Now, occasionally they intersect because you'll see like an Olympic style wrestler in professional wrestling. But most of the time, they are completely separate, parallel entities. And professional wrestling is a theatrical pseudo sport. It's not a real sport. The outcomes are predetermined of these matches. And what happens is people go into a ring and they pretend to have a grappling bout. And the winner, quote unquote, is whoever gets pinned, doesn't get pinned or doesn't tap out in submission. Usually, this is all, of course, an oversimplification. But professional wrestling has become enormously important for the United States, for Canada, and then in sort of offshoot forms for Japan and Mexico.
Yeah, I just want to jump back a second. Are you telling me that Abraham Lincoln's participation in professional wrestling was also fake? Was that real or was that?
No, because that's Civil War. That's the point. Wrestling was popular around that period and also before, because there had been Irish immigrants coming in and other forms of. I mean, look, people have been wrestling in one form or another since time immemorial. You go to any culture and there will be a form of unarmed person-to-person sport combat. And Abraham Lincoln was a wrestler. He got some initial local fame for being an actual competitive wrestler. As far as I know, it was actual competition.
Was he a wrestler or a wrestler?
That's an interesting question, actually. I'd say he was probably more of a wrestler now that I think about it. That would probably have been the accent given where he was born. But anyway, be that as it may, it became over the course of the 20th century very popular and was constantly, until 1989, in this weird state of epistemic limbo where you were told as the audience that everything you were seeing was real, but there was just, people knew it was fake. Like, even the fans often knew it was fake. This is often a myth that's told about pre-1989 wrestling, that, like, everybody thought it was real and they were buying into the magic. And it's like, you were buying into the magic, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you think it's real. And then, you know, Vince McMahon, the subject of my book Ringmaster, becomes ascendant and takes what was a very regional fiefdom-based system and just paves it over in the 1980s and sets up his own gigantic national operation, the World Wrestling Federation, which has one rival by the end of the 80s, and that's Ted Turner's World Championship Wrestling. But even by 2001, even that one is gone. He has no more rivals. And one of the instrumental parts of Vince's success and then the broader cultural success of wrestling in the 1980s was Hulk Hogan. He was Vince's star. And when I say he was a star, I don't know if Zoomers can or even should understand the hold that Hulk Hogan had on two generations of humans. Like, I don't even want to say wrestling fans, because I wasn't a wrestling fan until I was a teenager, but I knew who Hulk Hogan was. I very much knew who Hulk Hogan was. I liked Hulk Hogan without even watching wrestling on any kind of regular basis.
There's no way you could be a kid in the 90s or 2000s and not have, or mid 80s through mid 2000s and not have at least come across him somewhere.
Yeah, I was gonna say he was ubiquitous.
Absolutely. Like,
I think Josie, you and I are probably about the same age.
I'm 39, for what it's worth. Yeah,
and I'm 41. So we both grew up in that 80s 90s transition where Hogan was this like iconic kind of figure, and you could watch the WWF become this just huge cultural phenomenon through him.
Absolutely. I mean, it was through him that this subtle but very important thing happened, which was the first cartoon of this stuff. I always point to the Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling cartoon as an underappreciated turning point in the history of American labor relations. Because what happened was, for historically, the wrestler owned their labor. That was the one thing they owned, was like, the wrestling product requires me. Now, they didn't have unions, but there was some kind of leverage in that. And then they have Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling, where they have all the wrestlers, but they get voice actors to play them. So, like, Jimmy Snuka gets caught in a scandal and has to leave the WWF, but he's still a character on Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling. And, like, Hogan was instrumental in this corporatization and then sort of two-dimensional flattening of a lot of what wrestling was. It turned into a corporate product in a way that it hadn't been before. And, you know, I was talking before about Richard Meltzer. He was instrumental in me understanding what wrestling had been before Hogan, because it's really hard to wrap your mind around how much was reinvented, changed, or desecrated in the 1980s. Because the WWE, the history of wrestling, most of those tape libraries are owned by what is now the World Wrestling Entertainment Organization. So they can just centerpiece whatever they want, and they can start the narrative anytime they want. And the thing is, the story of wrestling, as understood in the United States and Canada by wrestling fans who are young, begins in like 1983. Like, they don't talk about what happened before that. You don't hear, like, occasionally they'll like gesture to Gorgeous George or some famous person from the past, but it's usually like an in-joke. It's not, there's no sense of history past the 80s, because that's when Vince took power, and that's when the WWF changed so much that talking about those previous eras kind of shatters a lot of the illusion that the WWF and WWF style wrestling are the only game in town. Like, you have AEW, which I love and does a lot of innovative stuff, but it's in response to this mode that was set up in the 80s by Vince and Hulk and then sort of solidified in the 90s. So all of wrestling is reacting to that.
If I can break in for a second, AEW is all Elite Wrestling, for those who may not follow.
Yes, I'm sorry. I was getting lost in the sauce there. But yeah, no, AEW is a rival wrestling organization that operates now and has been around for a few years. But, you know, and I'm not dissing AEW. It's just that they are the number two, and they're existing in reaction to the kind of wrestling that Vince and Hogan sort of pioneered in the 80s, which is, it's interesting. It's hard to describe, but it becomes this art of the sizzle without any steak. Like, it becomes the art of how do we get the sizzle and the scent of that meat to be the centerpiece and delicious without having to actually cook any meat. Because the thing is, like, Hogan was not a good wrestler for the most part. Like, you ask any wrestler, even his friends, and they will basically tell you, yeah, on a technical level, he kind of didn't know what he was doing most of the time. But the sizzle was great. All the hulking up and the leg drop and the characterization. And then in WCW, when he goes to the rival company and after a while decides to be, you know, he gets booked to become an evil character. And this is like a major cultural moment for a whole generation. And all of this stuff, yes, I gave a lot of credit to Vince in the book, but it was very much a collaborative effort. I tried to make that clear. Like, all of these people were contributing, especially the laborers who were remunerated, certainly. And Hogan was weirdly one of them. Like, Hogan, although he was a monster in many ways and responsible for a lot of bad things, he was also a victim of this system. Like, wrestling is a terrible industry. And he managed to work that system better than most people. But, like, I don't know. You hear stories about the stuff that any wrestler goes through, and you're like, how is a professional athlete of this level of fame going through this kind of humiliation?
What about Hulk specifically let him ride that wave? Like, what were the attributes of?
Yes.
You talked about the sizzle versus the meat, and I think that makes sense. Anybody that's ever watched wrestling, even though it is staged, they are still doing very impressive physical feats in terms how they interact with one another. Like you can imagine it sort of in the same way you would think about gymnastics at the Olympics, like a floor routine in the Olympics.
Except with a narrative. Like, there's a narrative to it. Right. But it's basically that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and in some ways it's more impressive because there's multiple people doing this at the same time and, you know, you're airborne and you're colliding. It is genuinely impressive.
And the crowd is in a gymnastics routine. You're not necessarily having to rely on the crowd cheering or booing at the right time, but you have to do that in wrestling. Anyway, keep going.
Totally. So what about Hogan's presentation, his attributes as a person, his attributes as a wrestler, like the things that what was it that sort of helped this process of paving along? So like what were the key things about him that made that work?
Totally. I have wondered about this, and I have some theories. It's hard to explain why a cultural figure becomes popular, especially when they're as unlikely to be popular when you look down the checklist as Hogan was. I mean, when you're talking about a pro wrestler, he didn't have much technical ability. He had a pot belly, which was fascinating. Like, he's jacked in the arms and like just this odd looking man, over-tanned, handlebar mustache, which was not very popular among people who weren't bikers back then. There's one component I'm getting at is the uncanny. Like, he looks odd, unique, and memorable. And there's that. But I think there's a deeper cultural identification or emotional identification that a lot of people made with Hulk Hogan. And I think that came from, this is just my theory, but my theory is he kind of wanted to be a kid as much as everybody else wanted to be a kid. Or I should say, he wanted to be a kid as much as the kids wanted to be an adult like him. Hulk Hogan, like many fascists, wanted to return to childhood. And there's this very childlike quality to his grown-upness. You know, you have all these kids looking up to him, and it's kind of like the old John Mulaney line about Donald Trump, which is Donald Trump is a poor guy's idea of what a rich guy is like. Exactly. And Hulk Hogan was a child's idea of what a grown-up is like. And what a good American and a good citizen is like. And it was all fake, but you got the sense that he wanted to return to a time when he was not at, I mean, he enjoyed the money, sure, and what brought him, but the life of a wrestler, especially somebody who was as held up as a show pony as he was, is grueling and kind of terrible.
what does that entail? So obviously having a physique like any pro wrestler has, and they vary, but in general, you're talking very significant muscle mass. I'm the resident lifting correspondent on Normal Man. And I mean, you know, for me, maintaining high muscle mass is hard and maintaining high strength is hard. Just how my body works. I've never done anything close to a PED. The most aggressive thing I've ever done to accelerate performance is like creatine. And even then, not consistently. So like, I am acutely aware of what it takes to get to a physique like all of these guys and many of the women as well are maintaining.
Yeah.
Is that sort of the biggest thing? Like just the physical toll of not only the performances, but also the training and the support you need from various drugs to look like that for decades at a time?
That's a huge component of it because wrestling is a visual medium. Like you really need, especially in the age of television, to have visually striking people that you're just flipping through the channels and you go, what the hell is going on here? And you stop on them. But is that the whole thing? No. You know, I mean, part of it, and this gets at another component of why Hogan was so popular, is charisma on the microphone. Now, there are definitely people who are in wrestling who've gotten by without being charismatic on the microphone, but they are few and far between. You have to be able to not only do the thing in the ring, but convey your character and the narrative through your voice and through words. Very often, back in the day, words that you were improvising on the spot. I mean, they would do these long TV tapings of promos, what they called them promos, cut into promo. And guys like Hulk Hogan, because they were the big stars, would have to sort of sit in front of this camera for a whole day and film regional versions of their ad for the WWF saying like, we're coming to your town, insert town here, and I'm going to mess up such and such. And, you know, that kind of mic delivery, these kinds of monologues are just as important. And Hogan, again, in this weird way, was uniquely good at it. Now, I say weird way because like his physique, it was kind of uncanny and not exactly what you're expecting. It was very stream of consciousness. It sounded, you know, like he had to talk as, it was like Speed, the movie, you know, like if he talked too slow, then, and he stopped saying words, then he would explode, you know, like these were what the promos felt like. And he had trademark phrases, and that part is so enormously important in wrestling. You need to be able to convey that you're more than just an athlete, you're a character.
That vapid sort of stream of consciousness thing. I mean, we're picking up a real pattern here. We've talked about this child's view of the world, this visual aesthetic being so important, this stream of consciousness. I mean, everything about this ascent screams fascism. It's just like, fascism, right?
Right.
On top of the nationalism, which was a big part of his.
Right. We haven't even talked about the American patriotism, which was baked into the Hogan character. You don't even need that part for it to be fascist, you know?
Right.
But you add that in and then all of a sudden, whoo, boy. Yeah, exactly. No, you're completely right. Like, this was the point of Ringmaster, of my book, was, yes, it was a biography of Vince McMahon, but it's called Ringmaster, Vince McMahon and the Unmaking of America. I wanted to write about how we got fascism in America. And I was writing that before it was necessarily popular to call it fascism. We were still having that dumb debate about whether Trumpism had anything to do with that political concept. And now I hope we've come closer to having a settlement on that, at least among the people who have not completely lost their minds.
Just listening to what you're saying, I'm flashing to Echo, right? Like, and his essay, Ur Fascism. It's just like.
Right. Umberto Echo. I thought you meant Echo the Dolphin for a second, which I was trying to figure out how that tied in. But yes, Umberto Echo and the Ur Fascism. Yes, completely agree. I mean, you read that essay and it sounds a lot like pro wrestling. Look, I'm not the only one who has made this comparison. I stand on the shoulders of giants, especially the great academic Sharon Mazer, M-A-Z-E-R, who I want to shout out, who I love very dearly, and who was really one of the first academic to take wrestling seriously and has been warning us since the beginning of the Trump candidacy. I mean, she was writing in like 2015, 2016, like, Pro wrestling fans can tell you this is going to get very bad if you let it go. And sure enough, there it was. So yeah, pro wrestling, because of the mentality, and I love pro wrestling. It's a great art form, but the way this art form has been manifested and the way, more importantly, the industry has operated has led to a lot of wrestlers and wrestling personalities becoming fascists and a lot of fascists enjoying wrestling in the United States, especially.
So then to return it to Hogan specifically, let's talk a little bit about his personal life and some of the things that led to what I think people that are my age and younger might know him more for than his performances in the ring or his role in wrestling. And that being his interactions with Gawker, the lawsuit that ended up destroying that site.
Yeah.
Tying with Peter Thiel. We'll get there. But as far as like his personal life, there was a lot of dark stuff there as well.
Yeah. You know, without, it's one of those things where it's sort of like, I want to just direct people to the Wikipedia, like, controversies section, because there's so much to get to. But yeah, I mean, the controversies really started in the 90s when it was revealed that he was a massive steroid user. But that sounds quaint compared to a lot of the stuff after that.
Or even compared to what a lot of dudes who are into lifting Instagram today are doing. I mean, PEDs are rampant at this point.
Right. That's the thing. Like, it was part of a weird moral panic. Like, I'm not pro-steroid, but it was part of this war on drugs moral panic that was happening. And Hogan was really a target of that. And, you know, in his personal life, yeah, he struggled with all kinds of use of substances and difficulties in relationships and was accused of being abusive. You know, you said we'll get to the Gawker stuff later, but, you know, has lots of accusations of behind closed doors, not just accusations, but recorded proof of him being very racist. And, you know, that said, you were talking about struggles. Something I always come back to, and I wrote about this in my little anti-eulogy, is his first wrestling match in the 70s, when he was getting ready to go to the first wrestling match, when he's being driven to the first time he's ever going to publicly wrestle, he gets sexually harassed and threatened with rape by Pat Patterson, who later goes on to be the number two at the WWF. And he wrote about this in his second memoir. Now, people say that Hogan made a lot of stuff up. Maybe he made this story up, but I don't know why you would. Like, it's so against his image to write this, to tell this story, that I'm inclined to believe it's true. But he went through the struggle of what a lot of wrestlers go through, which is this abusive culture of wrestling, where not only are you being forced to take a bunch of drugs that are ruining your body to look the right way and be able to do the crazy things, but also, like, behind closed doors, you have all these ribs, these pranks that they play on each other, which when you hear about the stories of what these ribs consist of, oh my God, it's like just ruining property, you know, shitting on things literally. And in the case of Hogan with this first match, this threat of rape, which he only found out after the match when he went to the locker room, was just a joke. And he writes of being terrified of this. And of course, the irony is then one of his last acts as a human is to do everything he can to get Donald Trump, an adjudicated rapist, elected president of the United States. So I'm not saying we should necessarily have all the sympathy in the world for Terry Bollea, that was his real name, but he did have a lot of struggles, and the wrestling industry is cruel. So it didn't come from nowhere. His dysfunction did not come from nowhere, I would say.
There's a really good section of David Hackett Fisher's Albion Sea about a hierarchy of pain in the Virginia Tidewater culture in the early southern United States and how important that was.
Tell me, I don't know about this. What is this?
So anyone that's followed me on social media for a long time will know I'm absolutely obsessed with this book, and we'll have to do like a full episode on it at some point. But basically the idea of the book is that there were four big migrations into the United States by English speaking peoples. And that sort of set the tone and led to the voluntary society that we got out of the American Revolution and Constitution and all that. So one of them was the Virginia Tidewater Society, which is basically the people who lost the English Civil War in the mid 17th century. Very, very Anglican, southern England, very property, wanted to recreate manorial life in the United States. And that's one of the reasons we got slavery in the United States.
I got to read this book. This sounds totally fascinating. Yeah.
Oh, we're scratching the surface here, baby. I mean, this is.
I know, but this is my kind of shit. So yeah. Anyway.
But yeah, in that pro wrestling really does seem to evoke that hierarchy of pain, right? That hierarchy of dominance and hierarchy of
absolutely
making yourself feel better for past pains by inflicting pain on other
well,
people.
Well, that was the essence of Vince McMahon. That was what I was trying to convey in the book, was like, the personal becomes political at this level when you give that much money and power and fame to certain people, because that hierarchy of pain begins at home. I mean, my spouse had this dark joke that she would have with me that wasn't really a joke, which was, by the time I got to, say, Steve Austin in my book, she was editing the first pass at it, and she was like, you gotta just, we're kind of sick at this point of the stories about the abusive dad or stepdad. It's every single wrestler. Like, we can just sort of assume that now. All of the men that Vince McMahon was able to gain incredible amounts of control over, psychologically, financially, whatever, were men who were abused or abandoned by father figures in their lives. And what ends up happening is that little home scenario and the quest for a father who will accept you and love you leads you to Vince McMahon, who is willing to manipulate that and who knows that feeling well because he was abandoned by his father and abused by his stepfather. Exactly. All of this stuff matters. Like, it's just, that is the hierarchy of pain. You're right. Once you get into a wrestling organization, you find out very quickly that if you are not the promoter, if you are not like the person who runs everything, if you are not the Vince McMahon of that operation, you are nobody. You are completely expendable because there are no unions. There's no meaningful regulation and protections for health and safety. Like, you're really on your own if you are a wrestler and you're not the promoter, because the promoter is the abusive father at the top of all of it, who can do whatever the hell usually he wants. And, you know, I hesitate to generalize about that because I just want to put in a side note shout out to what makes wrestling really great. And not again, but for the first time in the United States, especially lately, is a lot of queer and trans wrestling organizations that have popped up in the past decade. And shout out to the Boston League of Wicked Wrestlers below, who did my paperback launch. So I say a lot of this stuff about wrestling in general, but there are lots of wonderful small exceptions that are blossoming. So anyway,
right. My sense is that growing up, wrestling was kind of for the jocks. It was hyper-masculine performance.
Yes.
And it's still hyper-masculine performance, but the theater kids have taken over.
Well, that was the thing. I was a theater kid, and I always say there were two streams of people who would come to wrestling, at least as of the late 90s. And that was musical theater kids and sports kids. And the war between those two groups continues to this day at the highest echelons of politics. You have people who came to wrestling and started to understand that the surface was what mattered and that they should be homophobic and they should be hyper-masculine, they should be violent, blah, blah, blah. They should be edgelords. And then there were the people who saw it and detected, at least eventually, something that was beneath the surface, which is this inherent queerness and vulnerability. And, you know, even in high-level hyper-masculine wrestling, a wrestling match only works if one party is willing to show great pain on their face.
Since South Park was in the news this week with their new season launch, broadside against Trump, there is a really good South Park episode about pro wrestling that gets at exactly this sort of vulnerability.
There is? I didn't know. I'm so sworn off of South Park as a trans woman that I can't really bother with it. But I'm curious.
Understandable.
What's the episode? What do they say about it?
The basic setup is that the kids get obsessed with wrestling, and so they join the school wrestling team because they really like pro wrestling. And the pro wrestling coach, or sorry, the
like collegiate style, Olympic style wrestling. Yeah.
Yeah. He gets very mad about this. And so they don't do wrestling at school because they think it's, like basically that the coach gets thrown out for having gay porn on his, on his phone, which is just wrestling clips. And so the kids start putting on backyard performances, and it turns into like Shakespearean theater. And well, it's like they're doing all sorts of tropes that are, and they're getting at like how hard it is to put yourself out there every night and do these performances, and how hard it is when some of you, some of the other performer, other, some of the other wrestlers aren't hitting their lines right or whatever. And it's just, it's this really, really interesting.
That is interesting. I don't know how I feel about South Park in general, but I'm glad they at least promoted the art form for what it is.
Oh, yeah, they nailed it.
The South Park episode in question is titled WTF, and that is season 13, episode 10, for those.
WTF, yes, I can see where that came from, Mills. Got it.
Let's talk about Thiel and Gawker and Hogan and the intersection of that, because I think that, in addition to what we've talked about, Hogan being a representation of the fascist aesthetic that has, that is now dominant in a lot of parts of society, the information environment has suffered a ton, in part because I think of Hogan's role in what happened with Gawker. And I think there's a huge tie through there.
So Christ, yes.
Let's talk a little bit about that situation. Basically, Gawker published, essentially illicit recordings of Hogan and,
yeah, Hogan cheating on his wife and making racist statements. And some of it was posted, some of it was only seen by like the Inquirer or other tabloids and reported upon. But yeah, Gawker obtained compromising video, audiovisual material about Hogan that encompassed him being racist, homophobic, and adulterous. And now, here's the thing. Gawker went after a lot of people. There were a lot of folks who tried to get Gawker. And they tried to get Gawker on libel. And it's hard to actually win. Well, probably not for long. But back in the day, it was pretty hard to win a libel case against a news outlet because you had to prove, A, that the thing didn't happen, and B, that they were maliciously making it up and knew they were making it up. Now, what was remarkable about what happened with Hogan was the case was going for invasion of privacy, not libel. He was not claiming that that stuff didn't happen. He was saying that his privacy had been invaded. Now, this is not the strongest argument, but one of the reasons the case got to where it got to was, A, Hogan had it moved to a friendlier jurisdiction, which was Tampa, Florida, where he lived. And the other thing was Peter Thiel, who was looking to destroy Gawker for years, because in 2007, there had been this article that Gawker published about Peter Thiel being gay, and then later they had covered his one of his businesses doing poorly. So, you know, Thiel had been looking for a way, for a cudgel to use against Gawker, and he ended up spending a reported like $10 million on various lawsuits against Gawker, but Hogan was the really high-profile one. And we can, you know, you can look up the details. My colleague at Flaming Hydra, Maria Bustillos, wrote some incredible day-by-day reporting from that trial. But it did not go well for the free press in the end, because Gawker and its editor, A.J. Delario, were fined this astronomical sum that destroyed both of them financially. And, you know, by killing Gawker financially, hundreds of jobs were lost. And more importantly, this precedent had been set that if you're famous enough and you're rich enough, the First Amendment no longer protects you. You can get got for anything if the rich and famous want to take you down. And a lot of people didn't totally take them up on that offer until this Trump 2 administration, where now we're seeing it, the Gawker, the Balea versus Gawker strategy everywhere with Trump, where he sues CBS, he sues ABC, he, you know, it's not just the lawfare, it's the fear of it that then drives people into compliance. I mean, you know, Elizabeth Spears wrote this piece for the Times about Elizabeth Spears, who co-founded Gawker and wasn't there at the end, but wrote about that. And it's just like, it's this real death knell at that moment, where all of a sudden you realize that the one shield the press had, which was not wealth, we're not in it for the money. You can't make a lot of money in the press anymore. The thing we had was that shield of the First Amendment, and that was gone. And now you have enormous press capture, and what press hasn't been captured is certainly being threatened, and they're terrified.
I'm imagining the little domino, big domino meme of
Yeah.
Hulk Hogan, the little domino is Hulk Hogan sleeps with Bubba the Love Sponge's wife. Right. And the big domino is the collapse of the free press. And as a Florida resident, that is horrifying, but also incredibly funny.
Which part?
Just as the Bubba the Love Sponge angle. yes, yes. Who is, if you're not familiar with Bubba the Love Sponge, he is a radio talk show host who usually does a morning show. He's out of Tampa. It's an absolutely repulsive show.
Sure.
But he was on throughout the 90s and the early 2000s. Everybody used to listen to him driving to high school when I was a kid.
Yeah. In Chicago, we had Man Cow. Man Cow was our equivalent of that. There was this period where every city had one tiny Rush Limbaugh trying to act like Howard Stern.
Yes.
It was a very weird time in American broadcasting. I listened to Man Cow like every morning, and he was the Bubble the Love Sponge style commentator. And it's amazing when I go back in my memory banks, the stuff that people got away with saying. But like, wrestling culture was a huge part of that at that same time. Like, it makes sense that Bubba the Love Sponge would be involved in this story, not just because it's a Tampa and Florida story, but because wrestling and edgelord shock jock culture have been adjacent for
that edgelord shock jock culture, and also just the very Trump administration adjacent effort to intimidate people into not doing the thing you don't like, as opposed to actually using mechanisms of law or whatever, because it's too hard, because it doesn't work anymore.
No, you just use the illusion of force and you make yourself look big and scary and issue an executive order.
Both the illusion with an I and the illusion too.
Yes, the allusion to power that could happen.
There is something so vacant and empty there. And, you know, I do think it ties in with wrestling as well, because again, in wrestling, not to minimize the artistic value or the entertainment value of it, but it is an empty conflict, right? That is part of the appeal. Whereas we think of traditional political exercise of power as being something that really there's a there. There is an actual requirement to follow the law or, you know, exercise political power over people. Whereas with wrestling and with this current iteration of American fascism, it's pure vibes. It's pure bluster. There's no there.
Yes. Yes. It's vibes and permission structures.
Yes.
Because you say there's no there, but what's interesting to me is you get a lot of people, even on the left and the liberal left, that can't quite get this right now. They think a lot of organizations are caving when in fact they're just being, oh, I can finally be racist again. I don't have to care about DEI hires anymore. Like a lot of companies and institutions, when those first executive orders came down, much like wrestling, they wanted to believe that they held the force of law, and that belief gave power to them, like a pro wrestler. Like the executive orders didn't have a there, and yet the there was made by the interaction with the crowd. And the crowd in this case was like small business owners, quote unquote, who are little tyrants who just really like Trump and what he's doing, no matter what their protestations to the contrary might be. And when the executive order comes down, it's like, well, nothing I can do. It's just what the executive order says. The president said it. Can you believe it? The president. So that's what we have to do. It's kind of like wrestling is what I'm saying. But that's what I say about everything. So don't trust me on that.
All right. Well, Josie, I think we're going to wrap it up there. This has been an incredible conversation. We really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
Where can people find your work?
Yes, they can find me on my personal website, which is Josie, Josie, .zone, Zone, like the Twilight Zone. You can also find me on The Old Blue Sky, where my handle is, guess what, that exact same string of characters, Josie.zone. And if you want to buy the book about wrestling and Vince McMahon, please go to the book site, which is ringmasterthebook.com.
Definitely check out the show notes if you want links to anything that we just talked about with Josie. There will be links to some of the stuff that she referenced, as well as her work and where you can find her. Give her a follow on Blue Sky, buy her book, check it all out.
that's our show for this week. Thanks for sitting in with us and chatting about the world. In Charlotte, I'm George.
In DC, I'm Proctor Malone.
In outer Florida, I'm Low Tax Speed Run Enjoyer.
And I'm Ed from Boston.
Stay normal, y'all.